Okay, maybe we can start. So, now comes the the really exciting stuff after Adam Sudato's boring morning half. Text critical criteria, right? It sounds really exciting. So we I've tried to make it interesting. I'm going to go through a number of criteria that we use to decide whether a text is early or late. Just to give you a rough idea of what these criteria are, because sometimes people think that, you know, the idea of a lay text or an early text is like a random judgment done by academics in a kind of ivory tower. We're not really clued into reality, but actually there are some very clear criteria for deciding whether a text is early, whether it's later, or even later, or whatever. It's actually not that difficult to have some idea where these texts actually belong in a chronological sequence. So it's important to have, I think, some background about these things. There's two types of text, in a sense, two types of differentiation that we want to make. And the first type of differentiation is like the differentiating the early suttas, the whole collection of suttas from later things. Later things, commentaries, obviously, but also perhaps things like the Abhidhamma. What about Mahayana suttas? Where do all these things fit in, right? So it's the finding like the early collection is the first thing here. Now, once you have decided on what the early collection is, and this is one way of doing that, using these so-called text critical criteria, the second thing is, once you have a collection, is there anything within that collection itself that might be later or that might be earlier? So that is the second question. And both of these questions are important, right? Both of them actually matter. And the idea is to kind of to hone in on what is the earliest part of the Buddhist teachings. In other words, what did the Buddha himself actually talk about when he gave these teachings? So these are the two things we want to focus on. And I want to go through the criteria themselves fairly quickly. And then I want to get onto an example afterwards. I want to have an example. It's a bit more easy to understand what actually is going on there. So, the first criteria here is called linguistic criteria. Linguistic criteria, the idea with this is that language is always changing, right? If you go back in time and you look at language, how it actually evolves, there's always an evolution going on there. And if you take a particular text and you look at it and you can sort of put it into that timeline, into that, you know, where does it fit in that evolution? Then you have some idea of what kind of text it is and where actually it belongs, who spoke it, and all those kind of things. And with Indian texts, you have, you know, the Indian texts that go back to the time of the Vedas. These are the ancient Hindu texts or Brahmanical texts. And then they move forward into various strata of texts. You have the Upanishads, and after Upanishads, maybe you get the Buddhist and the Jaina texts. And then you have later Hindu texts after that, all the way up to the present day. And all the way along, the language changes all the way along, right? There's new vocabulary happening here. The grammatical structure is changing. I've also added compounding here because the Indian language is famous for its compounds. You get long, massive compounds of words all glued together. So these are some of the ways you can actually tell where the language actually fits. On this list here, vocabulary, for example, one of the suttas that I want to talk about afterwards is called the Anupada Sutta. And this sutta is found in the Majjhima Nikaya. But this sutta is interesting precisely because some of the vocabulary that you find in there doesn't really fit with the kind of vocabulary we normally have in the suttas, right? So straight away you wonder, well, what are these words doing here? These words seem to belong somewhere else. What is actually going on? Perhaps they do belong somewhere else. And this is one of the things I will show you afterwards. And actually, you find these words elsewhere. So this sutta seems to belong, in a sense, to a different chronological strata. This is a chronological period, right, from the rest of the suttas. So this is one way of then deciding that this might be later. And of course, if you go into the commentaries, if you go into the Abhidhamma, one of the ways that you know that the Abhidhamma is later than the suttas, because the vocabulary is very different. Not only is the vocabulary different, the sentence structure is different, the grammatical usage is different, the compounding, if you go to the commentaries, you get these enormous compounds. Sometimes you can't even read it, because it's once you compound words, it's much more difficult to understand the meaning behind it. So sometimes it's actually very hard to read the commentaries because of this compounding business. So all of these things are ways of deciding roughly where a certain text actually belongs. Okay, so let's move on. I'll just go quickly through these criteria. Something is missing here. Oops. This is Adan Sudato has done this. Okay. Okay. Yeah, there's a few missing here. It disappeared. Yeah. Maybe you put the picture on top of something here. It was worth it. Okay, let's have a look. Yeah. I think I have it here somewhere. Yeah. Okay, so that linguistic criteria is the first one. The second one is called stylistic criteria. And this is very closely related to linguistic criteria. Style and language are often very, very interrelated. And sometimes you can't really pull them apart. But stylistic criteria are often things like, for example, the floridness of the language, right? Sometimes language can be very flowery. Lots of adjectives, lots of supernormal powers, large, enormous crowds of people. In the suttas, you often have small crowds of people, maybe a few disciples, maybe a few hundred. In some of the later literature, you have like millions, quite literally, of devas and people and everything, and all kind of magnificent and marvelous things are happening at the same time. So everything is very florid, very flowery. And this is one of the reasons also, when you compare, for example, the Mahayana texts and the Mahayana suttas, even though they are given in such a way as to actually say that the Buddha spoke these things, when you look at the suttas, they're very florid, very flowery, lots of things, marvelous and amazing things happening there. And again, the Anupada Sutta, which I want to show you afterwards, also has a little bit of floweriness to it. And is one criteria by which, again, you can see that this might be possibly a slightly later sutta. So floridness is one way. Then there is repetitiveness. This is another aspect of style, how repetitive things are. And remember, one of the reasons why the suttas are so repetitive is because they're part of an oral tradition, right? So if you then later on have books which are part of a written tradition, you'd expect them to be different. Some people say that the Mahayana suttas, they are written or composed in such a way that they are likely to have been written from the very beginning, because they don't have the same oral feature, the same type of repetitiveness that you actually find in the Pali. And sometimes in the Pali, you find exaggerated repetitiveness. And one of the examples of that is at the end of, for example, in particular in the Anguttara Nikaya, you find that at the end of each chapter, there is what they call a repetition sequence. It's like a permutation of all possible ways in which a certain thing can be phrased. So you have like the five, for example, in the fives, you have something on the, I can't remember now, possibly the five spiritual faculties or something like that. And it says something like, you know, the five spiritual faculties, when developed and cultivated, they lead to the ending of things, right? Nirodha, they lead to viraga, they lead to giving up of things. Patinissaga, they lead to nibbana. And then each sutta is exactly the same, but you change one word like that. And then out of that, you can then create sometimes 500 suttas, right, by changing one word at a time. And again, I think, and I'm not sure if any detailed studies have been done about that, but to me, the sense you get when you read that this is late. The Buddha never actually spoke 500 suttas where only one word was changed. What is being done here is basically just the editors trying to fill in the gaps, right? So you get full exposition of every conceivable permutation that is possible to make. So again, this is another of those stylistic criteria there. Okay, so that is the second one. We have the linguistic criteria, stylistic criteria. The next one is metrical criteria. Meter, this is about verse, right? About poetry. In verse and poetry, particularly in Indian verse and poetry, there's a certain structure to the poetry. There's a certain number of syllables per line. And not only that, but each syllable has there's two types of syllables in Indian poetry, either longer or shorter. There's a certain sequence to that, to the syllables, maybe two long ones and a short one, and another long one, right? And this is this is called meter. It's the rhythm, particular rhythm of that verse. I know in much modern verse there isn't much rhythm at all anymore, but this is the way it traditionally is. And meter is just like language. Meter changes over time, right? So take some of the very earliest of the verses that are found in the Indian tradition. Again, this goes back to the Vedas. And you follow the development over time, all the way up to the present day. You see different meters being used. And not only different meters being used, but the meter itself changing. The particular meter that is used changes also at the same time. And there's a very fascinating analysis done by a man called A.K. Warder. He's one of the prime. He's late now, actually. He passed away a couple of weeks ago. And very fascinating book that shows the development of meter over time. And he is able, on that basis, to place certain suttas in a certain time period because of that. And the things you see there, for example, the Parayanavaga. The Parayanavaga is one of the most famous, perhaps, suttas in the Pali Canon. It is found at the end of the Sutta Nipata. And the Parayanavaga is this fascinating discussion between the Buddha and these Brahmin ascetics at that time. And this has always been considered very ancient because it's quoted elsewhere in the suttas. And when A.K. Warder did a metrical analysis of that, he found precisely that. This is some of the most ancient verse to be found anywhere in the Pali Canon. That's the first thing he found. The second thing he found, which is also very interesting, that was touching on what Bhante Sujata was talking about this morning, is that the Parayanavaga is structured according to a core teaching, which is a teaching between the Buddha and the Brahmanical ascetics. And then it has a framing narrative. We're talking about the framing narrative this morning, which separates the sutta from the rest of the material, right? And he showed that the framing narrative actually is later than the sutta itself, and actually the dialogue. And that's exactly what you would expect, right? Somebody speaks the sutta, and then maybe a few years later on people think, oh, actually, what happened? You know, what was that all about? And then the framing narrative gets put together, and the details are a bit more vague about what actually happened. So that is how the metrical analysis can be used. And then you have the Lakkhana Sutta. The Lakkhana Sutta is is considered by many to be a very late sutta, found in the Digha Nikaya. It talks about the famous 32 characteristics of a great man, which is about physical characteristics. And many people have sort of wondered what this is all about. And true enough, when you actually do the metrical analysis, it's a very kind of late meter that you find this particular sutta in. So again, it seemed to have been a later thing. So one of the things that you find with meter, again, is that as time goes by, it gets very structured and very strict, and it becomes very beautiful, right? This is what happens over time. You get to a poet like Ashwagosa, one of the famous Indian poets, and he wrote A Life of the Buddha in metrical, in verse, very, very beautiful. Consider some of the best poetry probably in the world ever done. But it's beautiful, right? It's not really Dhamma anymore. It's like the story of the Buddha with all kind of fantastic things, marvelous things, put in a beautiful rhythmical pattern. So everything is very nice. So now it's about beauty rather than about content. And this is what you see happening there. Okay, enough about meter. Doctrinal evolution, another criteria that is very useful to use, because you find that doctrine always evolves, right? Everything evolves. This is just anicca, basically, right? And one of the important things about doctrinal evolution is that the ideas that come afterwards, they always look back to ideas that came before, right? So when you read a late doctrinal statement, something that has been spoken after the Buddha, it always assumes what was spoken by the Buddha. In other words, it develops on the earlier doctrine. And this is how you can tell. You can tell something. Often they will quote from the suttas, or they will talk about the suttas in a way where it's obvious that they are meaning the original suttas, and then they will develop from that. But the original suttas, the early suttas of the Buddha, they don't look back. They don't actually look forward. It's just to the later development, right? For example, the suttas, you don't really find any Abhidhamma material, with a very few minor exceptions, and they look like late additions to the suttas. You don't find that in the suttas, because, again, precisely because it is earlier. So what is, like, if the suttas have something which goes before it, what do the suttas look back to? It's actually an interesting question. If the late doctrinal development look back to the suttas, what are the suttas looking back to? Do they look back to anything in particular? And the answer is that if the suttas look back to anything, it is the Upanishadic and the Vedic ideas that existed in that culture, right? Because the suttas had to relate to the existing culture, and they had to answer the questions that the Brahmins and the people at that time had. So they would have to relate to that. So they look back to that. So the suttas look back to the Upanishads. The later Buddhist doctrine looks back to the early suttas. You get this stage-by-stage evolution happening here. And some of the classical examples of doctrinal evolution is, first of all, here the Bodhisattva ideal. And this is something that started to happen after the time of the Buddha. And many scholars have said that, or some scholars have said anyway, that once the Buddha, you know, passes away, there is this sense of lack there, right? So the biography of the Buddha starts to be built up after the Buddha passes away. Oh, the Buddha is gone. There's a lack in our lives. You know, things aren't as good as they were in the old days. Let's start. Who actually was this Buddha anyway? We don't really know that much about him. Okay, let's start writing the biographies. Let's start thinking about who he actually was. And from that, that's the kernel of the Bodhisattva ideal. Then we get this idea that he practiced over many eons to perfect himself. And it's actually interesting. One of the suttas in Chinese translation actually has that idea, this, you know, standard idea of the Bodhisattva ideal, that you bow down to a previous Buddha and you make the determination, I will become a Buddha in the future. That's not actually found anywhere in the Pali Suttas, but it's found in the one of the Chinese suttas. And that's obviously, you can see there the kernel, the beginning of the Bodhisattva ideal actually starting to arise. And eventually, that ideal becomes in a full-fledged path. The Pali Suttas don't say anything about the Bodhisattva path, they talk about the Arahant path. And then the full-fledged Bodhisattva path arises. And suddenly, it is a Bodhisattva that you should become, rather than an Arahant. And that is, again, this evolution of the Bodhisattva ideal. Then you have the evolution of the Abhidhamma. And the Abhidhamma, of course, even though it is clearly later than the suttas, it is again based on the suttas. It has developed from the suttas. And one of the suttas, or the sutta I will talk about afterwards, the Anuppada Sutta, has some of these very early Abhidhamma ideas in it. So again, you can see how the kernel of the Abhidhamma happened in some presumably late suttas, and then it developed from there. You can see the development, evolution. Then you have the Abhidhamma Pitaka. The Abhidhamma Pitaka is not that developed yet. Then you have the commentaries, sub-commentaries on the Abhidhamma. And when people today talk about the Abhidhamma, they don't just mean the Abhidhamma Pitaka. What they mean is this whole mass, large, large mass of books, compendiums on Abhidhamma, commentaries, sub-commentaries, and all that together is actually what forms the Abhidhamma. But not just the Pitaka itself. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is a much later idea again. That is only found in Mahayana Buddhism, I think. That doesn't actually exist in the Theravada canon at all, or Theravada scriptures at all. The idea of the Bodhisattva ideal actually exists in Theravada, but it exists in the commentaries. Whereas, of course, in the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva ideal is the main thing, right? It's actually there, right there from the beginning in the Mahayana suttas. So that was kind of a new movement that happened with Mahayana.
So the Bodhisattva in the Theravada tradition didn't make that Bodhisattva out of the
I think they make a bodhisattva vow, but I don't think they say that it will, I won't get enlightened until all other beings have been enlightened. I don't think so. But I'm a bit hazy on that one. But do you know anything about that? Or?
I think that's
yeah.
As far as I'm aware, that's probably correct. Yeah. In the Theravadan tradition, the way that it's described is, you know, you make an aspiration to be a Buddha in the future, but you don't make an aspiration to put off your enlightenment until all other beings have become enlightened. That's my understanding. But yeah. As far as I know, I think the idea seems to have evolved as an internal development within the Buddhist traditions, and most of the elements of the Bodhisattva ideal are in place before the Christian era, even if the expression of them or the sort of final synthesis of them came a little bit later. But what you do get, definitely, and this is documented in some detail by Etienne Lamotte, in his book History of Indian Buddhism, is that there was a later synthesis of ideas of Maitreya with those of Jesus, which happened in the Silk Road and the Central Asian areas, where you had both the forms of Christianity, especially Nestorian Christianity, and those later developed forms of Buddhism. And so clearly what the people at that time noticed, an affinity of ideas. And so it became very easy to combine those two modes of worship. Yeah. Sorry?
Okay, very, very, very briefly, Hadi. Let's make it short, please. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes, I see that. You could use computer programs for these things, and to some extent you do already, because all you have to do, if you have the Tipitaka in front of you, you can do a word search, for example. You find that this word occurs once within the suttas, it occurs massively within the Abhidhamma, for example. This is one way of doing it. It's a very simple way. You just look at the frequency usage of certain words. When it comes to sentence structure, I'm not aware of any program like that, but it's not difficult to pick up. You can just by reading it, if you know the sutta as well, you can pick it up very easily. The feel is there straight away. It's different. You can see the length of the words. You can see you can also do searching for endings, for example, grammatical endings, that sort of thing. And it's very obvious that actually this is what is happening. Yeah. But it might be, at some stage, to put it on a firmer scientific basis, it might be perhaps something one could do, yes.
Yeah, there's been, as far as I know, there's been a little bit of work on that field, but not that much. If you'd like to write a program, we'd be happy to implement it on our website for you. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Let's do a bit of meditation before we move on. Okay. Okay, very good. So let us go on to the next one of these criteria. So this is the criteria which we can call comparative study. And this is, again, it comes from this, what Bhantasiddhartha was talking about this morning, that we have many different recensions of the Buddha suttas, right? We have the Chinese, the Tibetan, the Sanskrit, and we have all these other kind of little languages as well, and of course the Pali. And sometimes you find certain suttas that are found in many different recensions. One of the most famous ones is the teaching on Kamma, found in the Majjhima Nikaya, the shorter sutta on the analysis of Kamma, Chula Kamma Vibhanga Sutta, and that one exists in 15 different versions. So you can see people are very interested in Kamma, right? It talks about how to become rich in the future life, all this kind of thing. So this is a kind of popular teachings on Kamma. So it was very widespread everywhere here. So this is the basis of comparative study. You have all these parallels out there. So then you bring them all together. And remember, some of these parallels, they have been apart for like 2,200, 2,300 years, right? A very, very long time. And then you put them together and you see, do they match? And what you find that certain suttas, they have no parallels at all, right? It's quite interesting. And there are a number of suttas, for example, in the Majjhima Nikaya, perhaps the total number of suttas, something like, I can't remember now, six, eight, perhaps 10 suttas, which have no parallel at all. That is always a kind of slightly worrying sign. If they only exist in the Pali tradition, nowhere else, what is the reason for that? One possible reason is that it is a late sutta, right? So it didn't actually make it anywhere else. It was perhaps put together, maybe not created, might be the wrong word, but put together after the different lineages, after different schools split apart from each other. And because they had split apart, there was only transmission in that school where the sutta was put together. I don't like to say created, because very often what putting together just means you take a kind of standard, there may already be a sutta there, then you add elements to that sutta which are found elsewhere and you make something new out of it. It's not really exactly like a creation from scratch, really, usually anyway. So that is a bit worrying when there is no parallel. That's one possible meaning, that actually it is a later elaboration. It doesn't have to be that. Sometimes the reason is not found in another lineage. This could simply be that we haven't found the parallels yet. They are actually still to be discovered somewhere. Then there is the other thing which you find using comparative studies. You often find that certain texts have been expanded or they may have lost certain aspects. And you find that in the Majjhima Nikaya, you find, I think it's in the Majjhima 102, called the 5 and the 3, the Panchataya Sutta. And there you have a heading which says something like, I will show you, I can't remember the details now because I haven't looked this up, but there's something roughly, there is a heading saying there are 6 types of Nibbana here and now, or something like that. And then the sutta actually only has 5 of those 6, right? So you wonder what's going on. How come the heading says 6 and the sutta only has 5? And then you go to the parallel, and the parallel sutta surely has 6, right? And the interesting thing there is that the 6th one, which is then found in the sutta, the other one is found in the commentary on the Pali. It says, something is actually found in the commentary here. So presumably the commentary has perhaps gotten that one from one of the other schools, included in the commentary, but hasn't actually dared to put it back into the Pali Sutta itself because of uncertainty where that actually was the original. And that is another interesting point. The very fact that you have a heading which says 6, and there's only 5 of the things in the Sutta itself, and it's found in the commentary but not put back in the suttas. And what that shows you is how conservative they were regarding the suttas. Even though they knew that something was missing, even though they knew with a great degree of certainty that this is actually the thing that is missing, they never put it back again. So that is it's quite reassuring in a sense when you see that kind of things, because it shows you that they were very, very reluctant to actually change the suttas themselves, which is actually it's a very important point. Tanya. I think it is very rare that they actually create the sutras from scratch. I think what often happens is that they probably had some kind of sutra, some kind of framework that was already there. And then they added things. That was what Bhantasiddhartha was talking about before. They wouldn't take things out of the sutta, but adding things to the sutta was considered okay. And the reason it was considered okay is because if you have a framework and you just add more of what everybody thinks is the Buddha's teachings, well, all you're doing is explicating what is already there, right? Not really adding anything, you're just kind of creating an explication of what is there. That is one way. Before you continue, the second way is that, and this is one of the things that Venerable Nalayo talks about in his study, in his comparative study of Majjhima Nikaya, is that in the early days, it's very likely that the suttas were recited, this oral tradition, right? So the suttas were recited, and the commentary to the sutta would have been recited together with the sutta, because you needed the commentary to explain the sutta right there and then. Now, if they are recited together like that, it's very easy for material from the commentary to be taken up into the sutta. Because they're together, it's very hard to keep them apart, right? So it's an unintentional, often it may have been an unintentional expansion of the sutta that happened simply because oral tradition, the way it worked. It's hard to know sometimes, but what I think is likely to happen is that if a sutta doesn't exist in the Pali, it is quite possible in many cases that we just haven't found the parallels yet. It's pretty sketchy. The suttas we have are not very, we don't have a full canon of any other school. And when you don't have a full canon of any other school, you don't really have any direct comparison with any other school. The Chinese canon is very split, right? There's many different schools in there, but there's no full canon of any one particular school. What you have is you have the Sarvastivadins, you have the Majjhima Nikaya and the Sanyutta Nikaya, and all the parallel to those, and you have a Sanskrit version of the Sarvastivadins, which is the Digha Nikaya. And the other thing is, I think it's likely that in those cases where, you know, as you say, things were taken from one place and put into that one, that may just have been like a commentarial thing, right? The commentary may have linked the suttas together, and because they were linked together in a commentarial way, then that material got included by accident through oral transmission. The whole thing with the 32 marks of a great man is a very obscure area of Buddhism. Nobody knows exactly where it comes from. According to the suttas, it's supposed to come from the Brahmanical tradition, but there's no trace of these anywhere, apparently, in the Brahmanical tradition. So it is rather strange. But again, it may have been just started off with a bare list, then the commentary came along, and gradually it came into this kind of sutta. It's a mystery. Yeah, we don't know. Basically,
In a particular case, you know, you can easily imagine. Let's say if you had that list of the 32 marks, it is a bit kind of weird and so on. So people would be asking, like, why are these and so on. So then you could imagine that somebody would then give an explanation. This mark is a result of that act of karma, and it demonstrates that and so on. So this is just the explanation for it. And later on, then that explanation becomes part of the actual sutta. It wasn't actually that. Let's say it was a monk who was giving that explanation. It wasn't their intention that it be included as part of the sutta, but later on that distinction just becomes forgotten. Yeah. So this is how these things can gradually accumulate.
Yes, Venerable. Early and later Buddhism. Or do you mean time frame? Okay. Well, yeah. Well, I think, I mean, what we are really trying to do here is trying to sort of bring it back to what did the Buddha actually talk about, right? This is basically what this is about. So for me, early Buddhism is basically the sayings of the Buddha. Okay, maybe some of his disciples straight afterwards can sometimes be included in that. If you look at the Pali Canon as we have it, it is mostly spoken by the Buddha, but also a fair number of sutras, maybe 10-15% were spoken by disciples. So that may occasionally mostly be included, sometimes perhaps not. But that, for me, is what is the core of the Buddhist teachings. So, yeah. Okay, anyway, let's move on, because we'll be here a long time, I think, yeah. So we have this idea of texts are sometimes expanded, right? And these expansions often happen also simply because sometimes people feel that this sutta hasn't got all the details in there that should be there, so that sometimes they may actually even deliberately sometimes add something to a text. It's possible. There's one sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is a classic example of that, which is very expanded in the Pali version. It's just a list of teachings, basically. This is the Mahasakuludaya Sutta, Majjhima 2077, I think it is. And it's very expanded in the Pali compared to the Chinese version. It looks like it has been filled in. It's just a numerical list of teachings, of factors, essentially, that's in there. Okay. Then we have the last one here, which is teachings versus narrative. And this, again, was what Bhante Siddhartha was talking about this morning. And here, there's a distinction in the suttas. Right? When you read a sutta, you always find there's a part in the middle which is taught either by the Buddha or by one of his disciples. And then you have the narrative framework around that. The Buddha was staying in Sabati. There were so many monks there. He said this, right? And at the end of the sutta, it may say, the monks were delighted. One monk became an arahant, two disrobed, or something like that. That's what you find that in some places. And that's the end of the story. And obviously, it is very obvious when you read that the core of the sutta is the teaching. And the narrative framework must have been added afterwards, right? Because somebody else is saying that. It's not actually Buddha saying that. And the interesting thing is that when you compare the suttas, compare the Chinese with the Pali, etc., you find that the actual doctrine, the statements by the Buddha, the statement by the disciples, often are much more the same than the narrative framework. So when one text says, 500 disciples became stream mentors, the other one says, they rejoiced and were happy with the talk, something like that. That's very typical, that there's a big discrepancy between those two things. And you see this in the comparative studies. And from a historical point of view, it makes very good sense. Okay. So what can we say about that one? Do you want to say anything about this one? It's a friendly frog. Okay. Yeah. Really? Yeah. Okay. So this is early Buddhism for you. It's a different view of early Buddhism. Yeah. It's very nice actually. That one. Okay. So now we come to another criterion for what is early Buddhism. And this is to look at the historical data and geographical data, the data about people and all kinds of things that is actually found again in the suttas, and compare that to what is on the ground, what you find through archaeological research and these kind of things. And I did talk about this quite a bit last time, so I won't talk about that too much now. But things, for example, the suttas talk about the northern India being divided up into different nations. It mentions the large cities that were around in India at the time. And one of the very interesting facts is that those large cities did not include Pataliputra, or Patna, which is it called today here, which was the largest city in India only about 100 years after the Buddha. That's very interesting, isn't it? It's hardly mentioned at all in the suttas. It's only mentioned towards the very end in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And there it is only a tiny village. And 100 years later, it's the biggest city in India. So again, you can see that, you can sort of get quite clear when the suttas were spoken and when they were not. And then if you go to a work like the Milinda Panya, which you may have heard of, is that the questions of King Milinda, who was a king of Greek descent living in the northwestern part of India. And when you read that, the geographical situation is very different. Because then he talks about King Ashoka, about the famous Ashoka Rama, which was the big monastery founded by King Ashoka in Pataliputra. He talks about Chandragupta, and all of these things are events that happen much later on. So it's a very different historical and geographical context. And you can see that straight away when you read the suttas. Then you have the relation between Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, the Katyas in Pali. And this says something about the social structure at the time. Today, the social structure in India is that the Brahmins are the highest caste, and the Kshatriyas are the second highest, and it's very clearly defined today. At the time of the Buddha, it was actually quite different. At that time, it seems like the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas were roughly on the same level. And often you would see the Buddha having a discussion with the Brahmins as to which caste was the highest, right? And of course the Buddha would say, in the end he would say, well, actually it has nothing to do with caste, it has to do with your virtue. You are a Brahmin or you are a noble person by virtue and not through birth. But still, you can tell just from the way things are that at that time there was a kind of equality between these castes. There wasn't any clear sense of delineation as there is now. Okay, so there's one which has gotten lost here. Probably the frog took its place. I'm not sure. So this is the last one. Is what I would call direct textual evidence, and this is the kind of evidence when you read the suttas. The sutta will tell you, for example, that the Buddha was dead. Right? That's what it says. So then you know that this must have been spoken after the Buddha. Sometimes it's not spoken quite as directly as that. Sometimes it is just spoken by the disciple, and the Buddha isn't mentioned at all. Now that is another way of basically saying that the Buddha had passed away at that time. That seems to be the implication. Because otherwise, the Buddha is always mentioned, even when a disciple is teaching a sutta. Even if the Buddha is far away, he's usually mentioned if he's alive. So these are the sort of things that you find, internal evidence in the suttas. And of course, this is quite significant because the suttas themselves, they often say, the Blessed One said this, the Buddha said this. So how should we relate to that? How do we relate to the fact that the sutta says, the Buddha says this? And of course, I think it is fair that our starting assumption, if that's what the sutta says, is to assume that that actually is the case. That should be our starting assumption because that's what is actually spoken. And then if we find evidence to the contrary, then, okay, maybe we can doubt that actually happened. As, for example, in the case of many of the Mahayana suttas, I think the evidence is too strong to really believe that the Buddha actually spoke those things literally. So this is how you then go about these things. And of course, again, we also have the idea again of narrative versus teachings again. That is very clear that these are two separate things. In fact, quite fascinating as well, when you look at the narrative, the linguistic data again, the evolution of the words and the way the words are actually different there than they are in the main text. There's a grammatical evolution again. I told you this was going to be very, really exciting stuff. So, okay, now, please. Yeah.
Just a point I wanted to add, I've mentioned this before, but I wanted to repeat and emphasize it now that we've gone over these criteria, is that we can only come to really firm conclusions about these things when we have a number of different things pointing in the same direction. This is very, very important. None of these criteria in and of themselves is absolute, okay? They're all a bit they've got a bit of wiggle room there. But when you find several different criteria pointing in the same direction, okay, then you can be very confident about your conclusions. I'll just give one example of this, and this was referred to in one of the previous slides, is the last verses, the closing verses of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the discourse dealing with the Buddha's passing away in his last days and so on. And there's a few verses added at the end about how the relics were distributed and the tooth relic and these kinds of things. Now, these verses, first of all, they're at the end of the sutta, right? So it's the easiest place to add something, right, is to tack something onto the end. Secondly, they're dealing with a topic which is not really talked about in the rest of the suttas, which is relic worship. Thirdly, they're in late metrical styles, okay? So we know from the poetic style. We know from the vocabulary, okay? We also know because the commentary tells us that these were added. In one case, it says it was added at the Second Council, 100 years after the Buddha, I think, or Third Council. And in one case, it even says this verse was added by the Sri Lankan elders, okay? So that's found in the commentaries. So when we find so many indications all pointing in the same direction and no indications pointing in the other direction, then we can reach a very firm conclusion. The interesting thing about that is that it's often the case that we can be so clear. Okay, it's in fact quite common that we will have a situation like that where multiple criteria are all indicating lateness. We've referred here to the Lakkhana Sutta on the 32 marks of the great man. Again, that's a similar case where there are many different criteria all pointing in the same direction. So this also is something which gives us confidence that our criteria are meaningful within this particular context. Okay, and this is also something which is important to bear in mind. The text critical method that we're using and that we're talking about here originally was derived from a Western context where it was developed in the field of Bible studies and has been more or less adapted for Buddhist studies. And so sometimes people question whether that's relevant. They will say, is this meaningful? We're dealing with an oral tradition. We're dealing with a different kind of transmission and so on. So can we apply the same criteria? Well, this is one of the ways that we can say, yes, we can adapt with due consideration for the different kind of material we're dealing with. We can adapt it because we find that these results are self-confirming. Again, that multiple criteria are each mutually confirming each other. Okay, so this is something that's very important also when we're assessing things, and we'll come later to discuss things ourselves, is not to jump to too rash a conclusion, right? So this is, people often do this. They say, oh, this is dealing with this topic, therefore it must be late. No. It's dealing with that topic, so that's one criteria. Then we ask, well, what about the language? What about the literary style? And so on and so forth. So we should be cautious before jumping to conclusions.
Okay. Good, yeah. This next sutta I want to do actually has... Yeah, please. Yeah. I think you can... We can infer that on many grounds. And one of them is that the 32 marks are always mentioned in the narrative part, first of all, except for the Lakkhana Sutta, is always mentioned in the narrative part of the suttas. The Buddha never says, I have these 32 marks. I don't think any of the monks ever say the Buddha has these 32 marks. It's like listed, it's a story saying, oh, the Brahmin went out looking for the 32 marks. And there's a whole story about how the Buddha has these 32 marks. So that is the first part. It's just found as a narrative aspect. Then there is the fact that the only place where actually it's not part of the narrative, part of the sutta itself, is the Lakkhana Sutta. And the Lakkhana Sutta, again, is on many, many, many counts, a very late sutta on vocabulary, on metrical style, because it's a sutta full of verse, on doctrinal style as well. It takes this idea of kamma to an extreme. There's a number of criteria on which that one is late. You want to borrow it? Okay. Gee. Okay. And also simply because it doesn't, you know, it. Yeah. Is there any other reasons? In the Brahmanical tradition, either. Yeah. Is there, oh, that's right. One here. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I mean, the strange thing, as I said, is that it doesn't actually exist in any of the of the Brahmanical suttas that we have either, you know. It's not found in the Upanishads, it's not found in the Vedas. So the only reference is actually in the Buddhist text. No, nowhere. It's only found in the Buddhist suttas. And that is why it makes it so strange, in a sense. And actually, there's one more thing that I wanted to point out as well about the 32 marks. Some of the 32 marks are quite strange about the length of the arms. He can touch the kneecaps, you know, he has a protrusion on the head and all these kind of things. Fitness is flat, for example, yeah, all these kind of things, yeah. But the thing is that when you read the way that the Buddha interacts with people at the time, there's nothing to suggest that he's different from anybody else. For example, he uses the same kind of robes that ordinary people use, they interchange robes. When somebody at one stage asks, well, which one of all these monks is the Buddha? It's obviously he doesn't stand out, right? He's just one of the other monks. So if he had all these kind of weird physical characteristics, you would be able to pick him out and, you know, straight away here. He would just look very, very funny, basically. Yeah, yeah. And it just, I mean, you know, from my point of view, why would the Buddha is a human being, right? To have all these strange characteristics doesn't make any sense. So the whole thing sounds like mythology. It sounds like legend. Somebody's trying to make something out of something which not really isn't that Buddhist, basically. Yeah.
So this is the text that we're talking about here, is the Lakkhana Sutta, Digha Nikaya number 30. And, oh, move it. So one of the things which Ajahn Brahmani mentioned earlier was one of the linguistic features was the compounding, right? So here we have this word here, okay? So we'll just have to scroll over to the right here to actually fit the word in on the page, yeah? So this will give you kind of an idea of how far we are away from natural use of language already in this sutta, yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to give an explanation, breakdown of what that compound means? I think we'll leave that for another day. Okay.
Let's do some meditation again. Okay. Oops, what happened? Can I just close that one? Yeah. No. No. Excellent. That should be fine. Yeah. Okay. So let's see what we can do. How do you move down now? Okay. Good. Yep. Okay. So now what I intend to do is to have a look at a practical example of how this actually works. That's actually not the right one. What is the with the text? It's gone. The first part of the text. That's terrible. Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be very, very hard. That's the last part. Yeah. I need to have the first part. Otherwise, it's almost pointless. Is it anywhere else? Yeah. Yeah. And we can fix it up in the meantime. Okay. Okay. Okay, so we're going to have a...
We've got a bit of a software glitch here. The frog ate part of the paper. So so what we might do is have a early... Because this next part is actually quite dependent on having the text in front of you. So what we might do is have an early tea break, and we'll fix this up during the tea break. So if we come back at 2:15, we'll finish off this section and then go to the discussion group straight after that.
Yeah.
Okay, does that sound reasonable? Okie dokie. So let's have a tea break till 2:15 and see you back then.